When one looks at the decisions made by management, several characteristics of effective decision-making come across clearly. The first point is what effective decision-making is not. It's not clairvoyance. It's not the ability to see with a crystal ball all the unseen options and magically know what should be done. Effective decision-makers aren't smarter. They don't have any special lock on knowledge. They don't have the ability to mysteriously know the unknowable. They aren't just lucky either. They seem to test the knowledge brought to them for decision-making. Decision-making can be thought of as basically a choice between options or alternatives. Options and alternatives usually are detailed in terms of some form of knowledge, some partial facts, and some available evidence. From that partial information, managers must go ahead and make a decision. The word decision is from the Latin. It literally means to de-size. It's a dental term. An incisor is a tooth used in tearing and shredding. And when one decises, the literal meaning is to stop chewing. To make a decision implies that there has been set before management something that has been chewed over. It's been debated. One of the things, therefore, that we see effective managers do is to create debate. The manager seeks dissent prior to making his or her decision. When effective decision makers are presented with a staff proposal, they don't see their options as yes or no. A decision means there must be at least two distinct possible courses for positive action. One of the things Alfred P. Sloan was noted for was his ability to create advisor dissent. On one occasion, he had called his board of directors together to discuss a single item on which he wanted to spend a chunk of time. He presented the key issue in a few words and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I assume that we are all of one mind on this topic." And everyone around the table allowed as how they were all of one mind. But Sloan said, "If we are all of one mind, then I suggest we adjourn until we are not of uniform opinion." What Sloan understood as a decision maker was that debate is essential. There must always be more than one option. You create advisor dissent when you say to your staff people, "Well, I really like the proposal that you've brought me. I think it shows a lot of creativity and a lot of work on your part. However, I'm wondering what other options you might be able to give me." Now you're creating a situation where your people have to become more imaginative. You're forcing them to creatively regenerate, to think anew about some of the options that might be presented. Decision makers whose advisors create this discussion know that what they get initially isn't factual. What they get first is opinion. The first conclusions that get offered to you are just opinions based on partial information. When you tell your advisors to prove it, what you're doing is forcing them to go out and get some additional evidence, some more facts, and it's not uncommon for advisors to come back with a new and different recommendation. At that moment, don't criticize the staff person, saying things like, "Who are you, wishy-washy Charlie Brown? Can't you stay with your initial opinion?" Instead, you praise that advisor for having the flexibility to see a different way of looking at things. You should appreciate the extra effort. Another characteristic of effective decision-makers is that they insist on multiple alternatives. In this way, they can identify retreat positions in case the first decision doesn't work out. Contingency plans should always be considered in any major decision. Henry Kissinger had a general practice among his staff people when a proposal was being handed to him in writing. Instead of reflexively reaching out and grabbing that document from a subordinate, he would ask, "Is this the very best job you can do?" When you say to a subordinate, "Is this the very best job that you can do?" you're giving that subordinate a chance to reflect as to how certain or uncertain he or she is in their own mind about a plan. If they say no, give them some more time to give their best. It won't take long to get that extra 10%, and that 10% may be critical to a successful outcome. Another characteristic of effective decision makers is that they tend to make fewer decisions than those who are less effective. The less effective supervisor requires all decisions be brought to his attention. That's a reflection, in part, of his incomplete delegation patterns. And in part, it's caused by his own anxiety and his need to contain decisions. The effective decision maker knows, however, that since he must keep focused on key results areas, there really isn't time to be making all the decisions. There will be time for only a few. Every time you face a decision, therefore, ask yourself these questions. Is this decision really necessary? Do I need to make this decision? Should somebody else be making this decision? Reserve your time for those decisions that only you can make. Effective decision makers don't try to solve all the problems. They work instead on a few things. They delegate the other things, saving time and effort for those things that really need their attention. There are several rules of thumb that effective decision makers tend to follow in actual managerial practice. Rule 1, always do a cost-benefit analysis or a pro and con analysis. Where and how much will we benefit if we decide to go with this alternative? Does it outweigh the cost and the risk that's going to be involved? Every management decision you make involves cost and risk to some degree. So clearly spell out in your mind what those costs and risks are. Effective managers are gamblers, but in decision-making, they tend to be conservative gamblers. For example, in a study of how managers behave while playing cards, it was found that when losing, less effective managers tended to double their bet on the next hand. Effective managers tended to keep their bets the same. Whether winning or losing, they play for the average. Playing a longer-term poker strategy, they were content to go with limited gains rather than a high-risk situation. So go for moderate risks and assess those risks. Another thing to keep in mind is to realize that people are looking at you as a pace setter in the organization. You're like the conductor who sets the tempo for the rest of the orchestra. When people come to you for a decision, either give them one or tell them you're not going to make a decision. In studies of decision-making, it's been found that generally you're better off to either support the program that represents the best thinking and support that program to the hilt, or don't go with it at all. A third rule of thumb is to ask yourself whether the decision is reversible. That is, if you make a decision and it is wrong, can you back out of the decision rapidly? For example, you decide to go with one printing company to supply your firm's business operations. If they make a mistake, what's it going to cost? Well, there are a lot of other printing suppliers around. You could probably reposition in a matter of a couple of days, get the new print order up and running at the new source of supply. So I would say if it looks promising to go with Ajax Printing, give them the business and go with them. If you make a mistake and Ajax just can't handle it, you can always back out and go over to Brown's. On the other hand, if the decision is going to be very hard to reverse, like the selection of a new department head to work for you, it means you're going to have to go through months of documentation and legal hassles and a lot of problems in terms of interpersonal counseling. So when you make a personnel decision, that's the kind of thing you should take slowly. Fast or slow decisions aren't good by virtue of the speed with which they're made. You have to match the speed of your decision to the nature of the problem. Lastly, as we look at the characteristics that describe effective decision makers, we see that these people understand that there is both a rational and an emotional component to making a decision. Effective managers first approach any decision from a rational standpoint. That means gathering data, doing research, getting help from your advisors. As you've undoubtedly already discovered in your career, every decision is almost always going to leave you dissatisfied on this rational level. You're going to feel you don't have enough background. There will always be something you wish you knew more about. There's never enough evidence. But let's assume you have satisfied yourself on the rational level. You feel you have sufficient experience and everything seems like it's go, go, go. At that point, do what effective decision makers do. Listen for that biological or psychological feedback. Call it intuition. Call it apperceptive mass. Call it your gut-level feeling. But if that gut-level feeling, filling in the gaps of your knowledge, says go, and it's supportive of the rational analysis you've been able to complete, then go ahead with that decision. You may be right, you may be wrong, but at least all the signals you got were positive. On the other hand, if you find that the rational analysis supports the decision, And yet your intuition says there's something wrong. Don't go with it. I believe in managerial judgment. I believe you're able to sense things. And if you sense that a direction won't be good, that the balance is not in favor of making a positive decision, then don't go with it, no matter what the data is telling you. A classic story from the field of public health will illustrate the point. A sedative had been widely marketed in Europe and was thought to be perfectly safe. There didn't seem to be any problems with it. It had been widely prescribed, and in all of the testing, it worked perfectly. It was finally brought to the United States. In the Food and Drug Administration offices, a female physician was given the responsibility to review the new drug application. In the FDA, the people who do such reviews have final approval on the use of new drugs. Although there were literally millions of dollars at stake, this one individual had the power to reject the drug. She looked at all the statistics. Everything seemed correct. She looked at all the field experience and the testimonials from practicing physicians. Everything was in perfect order. All of the animal studies, all of the human clinical trial data, all of the correlational information was there. If ever there was a time when the rational picture was clearly positive, when the data was positive, it was this case. And yet she was troubled. There was something about it. She reran the numbers through the computer. Everything still checked. But something about it wasn't right. She couldn't put her finger on it, so she talked to her superior about it. She said, "I know this is silly. I should be able to approve this. But I'm concerned. I just don't feel in good conscience I can approve this." And her superior, having delegated properly and living up to the conditions of delegation, said, "It's your decision. You know that I'll back you all the way." And so she rejected the application for thalidomide, a drug that turned out to be a major cause of birth defects all over Europe. This woman and her intuition, an intuition which men also share, had learned that you have to make decisions in two stages, first the rational and then the emotional judgment. This is exactly the kind of effective decision-making that I would recommend to all. As we have considered together the traits, characteristics, manner of thinking, and the way in which effective managers approach work, people, and decisions, there is another area which we need to cover, and that's the priority-setting process. It seems that everyone has an agenda of priorities they'd like to see you and your capable people meet. And it's always a little frustrating to know that you can't do everything. There may be many problems crying out for your help, and yet there's only so much time. So you must cut and tear and winnow down until you reach a core of project and program priorities that will receive your attention. In essence, you become a judge and decide what will and will not happen. Usually the big problems, the big needs, are very easy to see. But in setting today's priorities, you have to consider tomorrow. Effective priority setters tend to make decisions and set priorities not just as the world exists for the organization in this year, but they also consider where it's going to be in 2 years, in 5 years. Let me ask this question. Where do you think your specialty field is going to be in 5 years? What does your company's future look like 5 years down the road? Think about where things will likely be 5 years from today, and then look at your present priorities and rearrange them based on that future scenario. It's a change of thinking from the way in which most people usually set priorities. They look at today's pressures, today's demands, and the things that people are hollering and screaming at you about. They set their priorities based on present demands. I'm asking you to take a broader and different frame of reference. Use a time reference as to what you want to accomplish within the next 5-year period. Identify and analyze what the future is going to be, and then set today's priorities. Try this as an experiment. Write out your to-do list of all the things that seem needed. Down the left side of that list, assign ABC codes based on the relative importance or urgency that these things seem to have right now in today's pressured work setting. Then down the right side, assign ABC codes in terms of what's going to be important or urgent in 1, 2, or 5 years, and then note the differences in the patterns. I'm not saying you don't have to service some of the screaming priorities from the left side of the list, today's list, but effective managers tend to be more mindful of the priorities represented by the future, and in 1, 2, or 5 years, they are vastly ahead of the game and ahead of their competition who are still playing catch-up. Catch-up basketball is exciting to watch, but it's not the strategy to play if you want to win the championship. Secondly, while you're thinking about priorities for the future, you're going to have to first get rid of the past. Are there a number of programs and procedures, projects and practices your people are involved in right now that in fact have no part of your future? It's up to you to eliminate those elements that shouldn't survive into the future. I live in Chicago, and the phrase hit list means something to people who live here. Do you have a hit list of things that need to be eliminated in your organization? Effective managers are their own best critics. They tend not to be defensive about projects they've created. They sit down and look at everything that's been created in the last several years and review every one of those programs, and they tend to do this on a regular schedule, typically every 6 to 12 months. You can do this at your next staff meeting. Ask your people to answer three questions that I call the organization renewal questions. First, what new projects do we think we should get started on? What do we want to see happen that isn't happening right now? Create a list and let your people have a hand in shaping it. That gives everyone a picture of where the company is going. The second question is, what existing programs or procedures are good but need improvement? Identify projects we need to continue while modifying them to meet the future. Maybe they're not working as well as they used to. It's worth taking some time to upgrade and update those programs. So what have we got that's good but needs to be upgraded? Again, your people can create such a list in 20 minutes. It does not take long. And the last question, what items should now disappear? I may have spent the last 10 years of my life creating it, but it's time for it to go. What elements of our organization need to be trimmed down? How can we get our unit lean and mean? Every organization is subject to organizational obesity. Picking up and collecting a little of this and a little of that, you can get heavy with these kinds of things. And the effective manager is the one who does not try to carry all this baggage into the future. So set the priorities based on the future and then get rid of yesterday. Effective managers also know how to set priorities based on the need for action. They decide what's the first priority, and then they go out and do it. They don't worry about the second and the third and the fourth item on their list. As they say at Texas Instruments, more than two objectives is no objectives. So the suggestion is do first things first, and don't do second things at all. Protect your priorities once you establish them from all of the posteriorities. So when the boss comes in the office and says, Clay, I want you to carry out this, this, and this, before you quickly agree to that management request, you may want to say, Boss, I'd be more than pleased to do whatever you need me to, but you should know that it violates the KRA that we all agreed 2 months ago was the number one priority for us to accomplish in the current operating period. If I do what you now ask me to do, we're going to sacrifice what we identified as the most important program undertaking we'll see in the next 5 years. If you want me to make that change, I will. But I want you to realize we'll have to pay a price. And then let the boss make the decision. But don't automatically give in. Don't automatically assume that the authority figure can remember all those earlier conversations. You have to help steer the ship when you move into management. To simply and subserviently go along with the piling on of more work means that you are sandbagging the boss's results. So help him or her understand the trade-off that would ensue and see it as a part of your job in defending KRA priorities. The boss will thank you as he sees that you're right. Now, how do I handle all these big problems? That's the difficulty with priorities. They're big, tough, undefined problems. Effective managers don't have any more work capacity than anybody else. But one of the edges is that they know if you break a big problem down into little problems, it's a lot easier to handle. Someone once said that the manager's job is like eating an elephant. The only way you can do it is a bite at a time. Another saying is that by the yard it's hard, but by the inch it's a cinch. These gimmicky little words are reflecting truisms in management. Break the project into pieces with a PERT chart, perhaps a Gantt chart, perhaps a critical path diagram would help. Somehow we need to piecemeal the overwhelming task and make it attainable at any given point in time for our staff people and for ourselves to accomplish. As a necessary outgrowth for setting priorities, there are also some courage rules that I would recommend to you. As you set priorities, it takes courage. Ask yourself when you're considering which piece of work should be done next. Is this a project that favors our future, or is it a project that only services the past? If it favors the future, go for it. Next, ask yourself, is this an area of opportunity? Is it a vague, unknown territory shrouded with fog? Or should I take on a simple problem and rewrite the policy manual for the 100th time? If the answer is, this is an opportunity, it's tough, it's frightening, then do it. Forget the policy manual rewrite. You'll enjoy more results. Here's a third courage question you might ask yourself. Is this something I believe in my heart of hearts should happen? Is this what my people and their collective judgment really believe in? Or is this what everybody else is doing? If everybody else is doing it, there's a very good chance it's the worst thing for you to do. First of all, if everybody else is doing it, they've probably got lead time in the market. Trust yourself more than you trust what everybody else is doing. That's just a step in managerial maturity. And lastly, ask yourself, is this something that people come out of their chairs all red in the face about when I say we ought to make a change? Or is this something that's safe and easy to do, and everybody kind of yawns when I mention it? Always go with the significant item. Setting the priorities is easy. Staying with them is what requires courage. Deciding what it is you're going to stop doing may be much harder than deciding what it is we're going to start doing. It's been wisely said that the things that matter most must not be at the mercy of the things that matter least.